feasibility.
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. Oops. We have a little technical glitch here. I forgot to turn off the radio right here where I'm at. So, take care of that real quick, and sound is much better. So, I am your host, Gia Scott, and today is June 3rd, 2008. As usual, there is a whole lot going on all around the world. Tonight, though, I'm going to talk about something a whole lot closer to home, at least for me. Tonight, I'm going to tell all of you a little short story, a true one, about a small mixed-breed dog called Rob. Now, Rob first appeared as a seriously injured and bleeding profusely dog on the streets of New Orleans. The man who rescued him spotted him attempting to run down the street, as he seemed to be bleeding from just about everywhere. Now, New Orleans isn't quite back to normal yet, but at the same time, it's normal enough that a small dog running down the street is on the verge of a really serious, probably fatal, encounter with a car in a continual traffic congestion. The man stopped and caught the dog, expecting a fight, because an injured dog really doesn't recognize rescuers as someone trying to help, and will often bite in reaction to their pain and fear. Not this one. Despite the bloody mess he was making of the man's clothes and car, he licked his rescuer's face. So then there was a trip to an emergency clinic and phone calls to find somebody to take responsibility for a dog with no collar, no ID, and that the vet believed had been used to bait a pit bull, as his injuries were all dog bites. His abdomen was torn up, his chest, both rear legs, there were several bites in his back, a rip across the top of his head, and his prognosis was also not too good. Despite all of that, a very small, privately funded rescue group took him on, knowing that he would have some horrendous veterinary bills. After his visit to the emergency clinic, then there was an extended stay at the regular veterinarian hospital, Rob remained sweet-tempered with everybody, licking the hands and faces of his caregivers with every opportunity, even as he laid there with tubes draining the wounds and IVs running into his leg. Finally, after weeks, he was deemed healthy enough to be moved out of the hospital into a more home-like accommodation. And he left the hospital and some very hard-working staff there, too, that was going to miss him. He continued his antibiotics to prevent infection. The wounds were healing well, and then it was time to start working on some of Rob's other problems. Now, Rob is a smallish dog, what I typically call a beagle-ish dog. Short-legged, he's black and tan with floppy ears. He's one of those dogs that seem to be perpetually smiling, too. Originally, someone had said that they thought he was a Rottweiler, and it sort of stuck, as he was deemed a Rottweiler wannabe. He doesn't look any more like a Rottweiler than I do, but hey, you know. His hair was growing over his scars, and it was soon obvious that there would be virtually no visible sign of his injuries. That didn't mean that his heartworm disease was going to vanish as easily, nor was his sexually transmitted disease. So, it was chemotherapy for the case of canine VD, and the treatments for the heartworm disease. And I started to tease Rob's rescuers about their million-dollar dog, because his treatments were all expensive and time-consuming. So now, months have passed. Rob has gone from a dog who looked like he was most certainly going to die any minute to a happy, bouncing dog full of energy and life and joy. Now, tomorrow comes his last step in preparing him for his forever home. He will be neutered. Next week, his last visit to make sure that his heartworm infection has been taken care of. And with that clean bill of health, he'll get his photo posted to PetFinder and start interviewing prospective families for his forever home. He has an adopted family now of dogs. Other dogs that are waiting for their forever homes. There's Doodles, the Catahoula puppy, a sweet little girl with very poor hearing, nearly all white with patches of blue that match her brilliant blue eyes. There's Mike and Mikey, the brother and sister duo, a pair of hysterically endearing LSU tiger stripe pups. And I do mean they are tiger stripe. They do any tiger proud to have their stripes. I've never seen dogs with stripes as profuse and as definite as theirs. There's also Tippy, a shepherd mix lady who's suspicious of strangers. It is wonderful when she gets to know you. She's been waiting the longest, as many families are wanting that cute puppy to take home instead of a full-grown lady like her. And she needs a family that will take the time to continue her socializing and training, too. Breeze, a 2-year-old German Shepherd, went to her Forever Home today, after waiting 5 months for that right family. Now, all of these dogs, they're rescues, dogs that someone has thrown away because they weren't convenient or they needed attention or whatever. There's thousands of these dogs every day who are being put down for no reason other than there's no one who wants them. Every city has a rescue group, some crazy dog lady usually, who goes out of her way to help the strays and abandoned dogs survive and find a new home. So, do your part. When you're looking to add a four-legged family member to your family, don't forget the perfect one might be the one that waits in some rescue group or shelter or pound. In between, you can help your local rescue group. Now, tonight I've posted a really cute little pendant, even though the picture isn't so cute. I was in a hurry when I snapped that shot, and I'm no merchandise photographer anyhow. It's a bone-shaped pendant, about an inch and a half long, silver-colored metal, and either clear or pink crystals on it. The rescue group is selling the pendants to help raise money to help defray their costs, and this cute pendant on a velvet cord is $10 plus $3.25 for shipping and handling. You can go to www.exogenynetwork.com, and you can see the photograph and read the description for yourself. If you email me, I'll send you a reply with how you can purchase the pendant for yourself or as a gift while supporting a great cause at the same time. And while you're there at the website, take a look around. There's a lot of information on the site, and it's still being added daily. Also on the site is a photo and biography of our guest tonight. An amazing man that I just had to bring on the program as fast as I could after I read about his film. And for those of you who know me, I'm not much for anything that requires me to sit passively and watch something. Dragons and Rings mesmerized me. I didn't budge for the entire session. There was no pause, and I'll finish this later going on that night. I loved it. And that's from somebody who normally has to be threatened and blackmailed into even pretending that I'm going to watch any kind of a program. So, go read my review at www.exogenynetwork.com and listen to the program tonight. I'm even more excited because we're going to give away one of his DVDs to our audience tonight. So, go to www.exogenynetwork.com and click on the live link. That's where the latest information for tonight's show is at. So, without any further chatter from me, let's get our guest, the fascinating Steve Mitchell, on the program. Steve, rather than have me botch up an introduction, I'm going to do the usual thing for me and have you introduce yourself to the audience tonight and tell them a little bit about who you are.
What an introduction. I don't know if I can beat that. You've said so much. That's so brilliant. That's so nice. Oh, thank you. My name's Steve Mitchell. You've just been talking about Dragons and Rings, which is a DVD film that I put together last year, based on, I guess, probably most of my life's experience, work, and sort of experimentation and various things into kind of stone circles, crop circles, ancient geometry, all that kind of wonderful stuff. What can I say about myself? I started off as a youngster, really, kind of looking into all these kind of weird and wonderful things that were happening around me. I lived approximately about 5 miles or so away from the Ridgeway, which is an ancient trackway in England that runs approximately 80 miles and ends up in a huge stone circle surrounding the village of Avebury. So I was surrounded by all these ancient sites and so forth, as well as various kind of mystic things going on, and wanted answers, wanted to know what it was all about. And being a musician and being creative, I kind of tapped into that element of myself, and was also very into the sciences, maths, physics, and really looking for that place where they all met, the maths, the physics, the music, the quantum, the esoteric, the ancient, the modern, and kind of feel as though I've put something together. And it's really nice that you kind of say that you've managed to watch it all in one go and it kind of actually meant something.
Well, I thought it was great. I mean, I realize, you know, you don't know me, but I'm really horrible. My family makes jokes about the fact that I'm completely incapable of watching a program. I do own a television. Mm-hmm. When my daughter gets here for a visit, because she lives out of state, when she flies in, one of the first questions she asks me is usually, where's the TV? And the answer is usually going to be things like, it's behind the futon, it's in the closet. It's going to be someplace like that because it gets in the way. It collects dust, and if I don't see it, I don't have to dust it, right?
They're strange things, televisions, aren't they?
Yeah.
They kind of channel all this information into our brains, into our minds, and seduce us with these images and these kind of sounds and the news and so forth. And in the end, you know, you either get caught up in that seduction or you just walk away and think, well, is it about something else?
Yeah, well, you know, maybe it's because I grew up in a rural area, and I remember one year we didn't have television because a jet hit the tower that had all three stations broadcasted. It took out the tower, you know? We didn't have TV that year. No, I mean, you know, we played outside. What did we know, you know?
Absolutely. And you say all three stations as well.
Yeah, all three stations.
Exactly.
Yeah, people today have no clue what it was like,
no.
You know, 20, 30 years ago, you know, it was, or 40 years ago, or however many years ago it was.
I live in quite a rural place. We used to have a program on television called Why Don't You? And the theme tune for Why Don't You over here was, why don't you just switch off that television set and go and do something useful instead? So I did. And we used to go out and play in the trees and everywhere. You don't want telly, do you?
Well, yeah, you know, if it was summertime, we were outside. You know, I can't imagine, you know, when school got out in the spring, I didn't wear shoes again unless we had to go somewhere until school was starting again. I cannot imagine running barefoot like that now.
No.
I would be, ow, ow, ooh-wee. I don't go to the bathroom at night without putting on shoes, you know?
Do you? Oh.
It comes from years of living on the desert where things that were on the floor at night could have stingers, fangs, or stickers. I mean, it's just, you banged out your shoes and you put them on before your feet hit the floor. You never forgot to bang out either, because once you got the joy of sticking your foot into a shoe that already had an occupant, you never forgot it.
So does this mean you actually had to hunt for the telly and find the telly to watch my film?
Actually, I cheated, okay? I used my computer.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I didn't have to hunt out the television to watch your film. Now, I've since killed the computer, so if I want to watch it again, I was like, oh, I want to watch it again. I was like, I got to get the TV out, you know. And,
it's tricky, isn't it? I designed it on purpose. There's so much information to try and get into an hour. You can't do much longer than an hour, otherwise you just lose people's attention. And yet, to take people from that kind of starting point of what is energy and what is quantum mechanics and what is science and how does it tie in to everything from stone circles, ley lines, crop circles, all these kind of weird things, to get that into an hour is so tricky. And like you say,
yeah,
you do need to kind of watch it more than once to pick up even the kind of top level.
Well, especially if you're like me and really lack practice at watching things, you know? I honestly can't say the last time I watched something. I think I watched a movie last winter with some friends, or at least most of it. I was sort of there, you know? I'm not a real good example of a movie critic or a TV critic or anything that involves, you know, the visual sort of thing, because I don't. That requires I sit still and I'm passive. You know, when you're reading something, at least you got to hold the book and you got to turn the pages and, you know, if it's on a website, you're scrolling through it. I mean, you're doing something, interacting with it somehow. And so I feel, you know, I find that having to wait for things to happen a little strange. So why did you choose the name Dragons and Rings?
Do you really want to know?
Yeah.
We were talking just before we came on air about stories, weren't we?
Yeah.
Are they the real stories, the true stories, or the made-up stories of how things happened. There's two reasons, really. One, stupidly, because it's actually a lyric from a song by a heavy metal band, and I quite liked it. And secondly, the dragons aspect ties into the energy aspect of the film. The film's about rings, as in circles of stone, and ley lines. And ley lines have been known down the centuries, down the ages, as dragon lines, and often associated with what is called dragon energy. Some people claim to have seen dragons and so forth, but really because of that, and it gives that kind of archaic, kind of nice sound to it, doesn't it?
It was an interesting title. It was like dragons, you know. Yeah, there's the magical, mystical, scary sort of dragon, you know, and wasn't there a saint that went around slaying dragons, too?
George, yes.
Okay, it tells you my mythology is not up to par, either. And then there's the cute, cuddly dragon, you know, Puff the Magic Dragon, and the cute, cuddly cartoon dragons. And I think there's even a cartoon that's currently being aired in the United States that has dragons in it somehow. And then there's the Asian dragon, which to me looks like a big scary snake.
Yeah.
You know, so there's lots of different kinds of dragons, and it's a real persistent concept in human mythology.
It is, isn't it? It's quite important, that really, the fact that it's settled back into the back end of our back end of our brain and the back end of our ancestral memory. We've got this kind of conception of this creature, this very sinuous creature, that kind of looks almost like a waveform in itself, which is where it ties into the energy. I guess,
and yet it has enough resemblance to dinosaurs that, you know, you can really kind of twist the two together and say, did our ancestors somehow carry a racial memory that long?
It's interesting, isn't it? I think, you know, in the field of cryptozoology, there are various people who claim that dragons may well have existed. I'm afraid, from my perspective, the jury's totally out on that. I think what happens in the brain is we are able to perceive maybe a little bit more than we think we can. In fact, we perceive a lot more than we think we can. And what we tend to do with that information is guess as to what it might look or sound or smell like, if that makes sense. It's a bit like if you look at the spectrum of light, the spectrum that we see, red through to violet, is only a small part of the spectrum, because you've got the ultraviolet at one end and the infrared at the other end. And yet we kind of make something out of that scale, that kind of red to violet area. And the same thing goes for shapes and things. We compare things, we compare shapes, we compare colours, we compare sounds with stuff that we've got in our memory. And if it isn't there, we have to kind of make something up and rely on what are called archetypes, which is a sort of Jungian concept of ideas within the back end of our brain somewhere. There are these archetypes ranging from angels to fairies to so forth. Do they actually tie into something specific that was there, or do they tie into something that maybe we've had to make up to fit the facts? It's quite interesting that that the whole dragon kind of snake kind of serpent thing features extraordinarily highly in most, if not all, creation myths. It's always there as part of that mythology, and certainly from my kind of looking at it, that tells us a lot about the aspect, if you like, of the energy that's involved in that process, the energy that's involved also from a genetic DNA point of view as well.
Well, yeah, and the dragon is, you know, the whole sort of dragon-y thing is real persistent. The area I used to live in, there was a creek, and Native American mythology in the area included the fact that that particular creek was supposed to have a white feathered serpent that lived in it. And I know even during the years that I lived there had been a few sightings of this white feathered serpent.
All right.
Who was rather murderous, by the way, you know.
Right, yeah. Hungry, I think it's
called. Yeah, hungry, yeah. I don't remember if it ate only women or ate only men. It did one or the other, and whatever one it was eating weren't supposed to swim in the creek. I have to admit I've forgotten most of that story that I was told. But it was kind of eerie, because, that particular creek, there is a tendency, when you're out there, you'll get a feeling something's there. I spent a lot of time out there, and I refused to swim in the water because too often something weird would happen, and I wouldn't let my kids swim in the water either.
Right. When you say something weird would happen?
Just nothing dangerous, nobody, because we're swimming in very deep water there.
Yeah.
Like 90, 100 feet, or whatever. Once it's over your head, it doesn't matter. But, just odd little things that would just make the hair in the back of your neck stand up.
Mm.
And you're like, I think it's time to go. and you would blame it on your imagination because, face it, when you're out sitting on some rather surreal-looking sandstone cliffs, and you've got the water out in front of you and the moon's full and the light is like it is, your eyes can play tricks on you. It can be your imagination, right?
What's easier, though? Is it easier for you to blame it on your imagination, or is it easier for you to blame it on something external?
Sometimes it's easy to go one way, and sometimes it's easier to take the other way. I do know that our minds are going to try to match patterns. I've had personal experience with it as well as, excuse me, I did some research about it. When you see an image and your mind tries to match it to a pattern, a known pattern, to say what it is, on occasion, it does a mismatch, okay? And, on my case, I was camping on the Mogollon Rim in Arizona. This is a high forest of ponderosa pines and oak and whatnot. And I looked out from the tent, and I had a light-colored pickup truck. And in front of the pickup truck, standing there motionless, I see a dark image. And I'm like, what is that? And you squint in the dim light, and because it's nighttime, it's just seeing with starlight. There wasn't even a moon. And my mind says, it's gorilla. And I'm like, no, it's not a gorilla. There are no gorillas on the Mogollon Rim of Arizona. They don't live here. There's no old gorillas here. I looked at it several times, and my daughter was a teenager at the time, and eventually she woke up and she said, what are you doing? I said, look out the window and tell me what is in front, what that dark shape is on the truck. She looks out and she says, it's a garbage bag tied to the antenna. My mind kept telling me it was a gorilla, and I kept telling it, no, it's not a gorilla. But it was sort of that vaguely hominid shape, and it kept telling me it was a gorilla. Now, this gorilla hasn't moved because the garbage bag's not moving, but that's what my mind kept doing to me. Now, someone else looked at it. She, maybe she'd never seen a gorilla. I don't remember. I'm sure she had, but, her mind didn't match it to a gorilla. She matched it to what it really was. I always tied the garbage bag to the antenna. I always did that. I didn't remember that night.
No. It comes down to survival, doesn't it? If you think way, way, way back, when we would have been literally cruising the savannas, the deserts, the grasslands, the woodlands, the forests, desperately looking for something to eat whilst consequently, something else was cruising the same space looking for something to eat, i.e. us, then it would be advantageous to be able to take note of any little movement, any little shape, and assess it. And if it
and quickly
bad,
match it to a known.
Yeah, you either match it or you run.
Yeah.
And if you can't match it,
and
what's
like
to
I
do?
Said, on occasion, there's a mismatch.
But of course, from a survival point of view, it's far better to run away from a from a garbage bag tied to your antenna than it is to wait around to see if it's a gorilla that wants to eat you.
Right. Well, I don't know if gorillas... I don't think gorillas eat people, but you know, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I have to admit, in the United States, I have not encountered that many gorillas in the wild.
Right.
I've seen them in the zoo, and that's been my gorilla experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I have to admit. Yeah, you know, but, you know, it does, you see things, and sometimes you're not sure. Is it your imagination? Did I mismatch the image? It helps always if you have a second person to say, what is that?
Yeah, because either they tell you exactly what it is, or they also join in and you both run away.
Yeah, yeah.
But at least you feel happy because the other person has matched what you think it is, and at least you're both kind of bolstering each other up as you're legging it into the distance.
Yeah, well, you know, the same daughter a few years earlier, camping in the same general area, I was showing her the little people dancing in the oak tree.
Mm.
And her brother, and they saw them, you know. They saw the little people dancing in the tree, you know.
Mm.
So, yeah. you know, it just depends.
Mm. I think one of the things that you mentioned there just a few minutes ago that's kind of quite interesting is the association with these serpent beings with water. It certainly runs through, again, a lot of mythology come ancient knowledge, whatever you want to call it, but dragons do associate in with water. And if you think about water as being ripples and waves, you can easily get that kind of sinuous kind of serpent shape, if you like, in your imagination to form from whatever's going on there.
Or if you want to take the cryptozoology tactic, it's more likely that dragon-like creatures would survive in deep bodies of water, isn't it? For a longer period of time?
I would guess so, yes. If you look at something like an eel, if you look at those kind of animals, then you can kind of quite see where that association might well be made. Certainly flying around on wings doesn't sound the best
well,
kind of environment.
You know, I always got the impression from most of the images that I saw of dragons that the wings were really not so much for flying through the air as they were maybe for display or perhaps even flying through the water. Because
like
they were
fins.
So small in comparison to their bodies.
Mm. Yeah, far more like fins, aren't they, when you think about them like that. The other thing you kind of mentioned there as well was the aptitude for them to be after either male or female. I think most of the dragon lore seems to indicate females were, if you like, their source of nutrition, particularly virgin females for some reason or another. And if you trace this back in mythology, trace it back in ideas, it goes way, way back, if you like. The best example is Genesis, but you do find it in other mythology as well. This concept that the serpent is associated with wisdom that's associated with reproduction, basically, and that has its kind of basis way back when we kind of decided not to be nomadic but more to be settlers. And once you start settling in a land, you have to become more aware of the time, of the seasons and so forth, and the undulations of time, and consequently you have to plan procreation far more than if you're nomadic and following the path of the sun.
This is true because an agrarian lifestyle is actually much more labor intensive than a hunter-gatherer lifestyle.
I actually missed the beginning of that. I don't know whether you had your hand over the mouthpiece or something.
No, I actually hadn't moved. No, I just said that an agrarian lifestyle is much more labor intensive than a hunter-gatherer's lifestyle. It requires more effort to produce the food.
Absolutely, yes. And that's a key point as well, because it requires so much effort. It requires people to, if you like, invest in it. And once people start investing in things become property. And then we kind of start getting into the whole aspect of would you kill, if you like, for that piece of land that you've invested your time in that's going to make your food, as opposed to would you simply go and gather and hunt somewhere else?
Yeah. It kind of makes you wonder, you know, why did they shift? The only thing I could, you know, really speculate on is that it was a more stable supply.
It's tricky. You know? I've not worked out why. I don't know if anyone else has worked out why. I almost put it down to laziness.
They got tired of traveling?
Yeah, exactly. I'm just kind of putting a book together at the moment, actually, based on the back end of the Dragons and Rings stuff, really expanding on the DVD and kind of explaining some of the stuff in greater detail, as well as throwing a load of stuff else in there. One of the things I was looking at was the whole symbology for the sun, the solar symbology, and one of the great kind of well-known archetypal images is the Ankh, the Egyptian Ankh. And someone pointed out that it looked a little bit like a sandal. And again, if you go back to this concept that we started out nomadic and then we settled, when we settled, the position of the sun becomes far more important because it tells us when winter and summer are. But if it's relating into the concept of a sandal, then maybe, you know, again, there's some etymology in there, some kind of concept that it originally related into the fact that we followed the sun. We literally walked. We had sandals, if you like. We had footwear and followed the sun, a bit like, you know, when you were saying earlier on you wouldn't go out without your shoes on. Maybe there's a link there. I don't know. Maybe we literally did just kind of get to that point where it's like, gosh, can't be bothered to walk anymore. Let's just kind of stay here. We actually kind of like it here. It's nice, you know. We walked past this place last year and it was kind of nice, and maybe if we just stay here, it's kind of the best of both worlds. I don't know. It's hard to say whether there was a specific kind of desire or whether it was just a kind of general trend. I don't know. I haven't researched that part yet to find out whether something happened. Maybe someone could come up to me and say, oh, whoa, this is it. I don't know.
There's times when I think, you know, it'd be so nice to just have a window back in time so I could see why. Why did they do this? Why did they do it this way? You know, wouldn't that be cool? That'd be really, if you really could, you know, just have a window. And that'd be one way to get me to, you know, sit and watch a TV. Play that. Play reality, you know?
Proper reality TV, you mean?
Yeah, the old reality TV. Let me look at what, you know, my ancestors were doing 1,000 years ago. And why did they do the things that they did?
I think something I was discussing with a colleague of mine the other day, it's really important, certainly something that's come out of a lot of my research, is that we have lost this, we've lost something, haven't we? We've lost whatever it was that our ancestors had at some point. And I don't know whether we've actually gained benefits by settling down, by kind of being bound by technology.
I think the facet that we have neglected in our pursuit of technology and science is we've neglected the non-physical, the spiritual, you might say, side of ourselves.
Absolutely.
You know, and not in terms of religion. We've got more religions than I didn't even begin to keep track of. But the spiritual sense of ourselves and the world around us, the part of it that we can't see, touch, smell, measure.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think it also there's that connection we've lost there. We've lost the connection with literally the earth, with whether you want to kind of perceive it as the earth mother or the being in terms of the Gaia kind of theory, or just literally our place that we live, you know, in terms of we don't kind of not necessarily understand it, but we don't kind of feel that we're part of it. We feel we own it, and we feel we're entitled to things from it, but we don't kind of have that symbiotic relationship that maybe was there when we were forced to kind of respect
it. We don't, you know, live with our planet so much as we conquer our planet. You know, it's become a battle rather than a symbiotic relationship.
Absolutely.
You know, same thing with nature, you know. And then we're seeing really, really strange things. I was reading some research a few months ago that they were taking kids. I don't remember what their issue was, whether it was, you know, ADHD or behavior problems or whatever. But they were taking these kids and simply exposing them to nature.
Mm.
And guess what they discovered? The kids did better across the board.
I bet they were far better. I bet all of a sudden all these so-called challenging behaviors.
My son was ADHD, and, you know, there was a point where the school was really pushing me to put him on medication.
Mm.
And, you know, I mean, with one of the many appointments with the doctor, and they're once again pushing the medication, and I told the doctor, I said, okay, I'm thinking about putting him on it for a month. I said, not because I think it's the best thing for him, but, you know, I've got a lot going on right now, and it's the best thing for him because it's going to give me a break long enough for me to come at this again.
Mm.
And the doctor just kind of looked at me. Now, I ultimately chose not to do that, but, the real issue was I was trying to juggle. I'd lost a job. I was moving. You know, there was a lot of things going on in my life, and I wasn't coping real well with his additional issues. But then I discovered that if I went out to the forest once a week and took him, didn't matter what we did, didn't matter who went with us, didn't matter if we went hiking, camping, picnicked, just went for a drive out there, went and sniffed a tree, didn't make any difference what we did. Just going. Being out there even for a half an hour. And then the whole week was good. We just reestablished that connection with nature, and with, you know, our own roots, you might say, and the whole idea, because nature's, it's continually in transition, but yet it isn't. It's the same always. The, you know, it moves at a much different pace. Things mean things differently. You know, right down to the same tree that I showed my kids, the little people dancing in. Years later, my daughter's an adult, she's married, she lives, you know, still in the same area, and she tells me she went out and saw the tree, and she was very upset about this. She says, Mom, I think it's dying. This is a very old oak tree. It might be dying, I don't know, but, you know, I was really surprised at how upset she was that this tree that, you know, it's an hour from where she lives, and nobody lives near this tree at all, but this particular tree might be dying. You know, because of the association she had with us being out there, our connection with nature there, even to the old stories of the little people, you know?
Mm.
But it did. It made a huge difference just to take them out there and just be out there. You know, like I said, didn't matter what we did.
Absolutely. And like you say, I think it's definitely something, you know, that everyone ought to do. But it's also, how do you bring that into your day-to-day living? How do you bring it into your daily life so that you have that kind of richness, you have that specialness, you have that spirituality?
Especially if you live in an urban area. Not all urban areas have green spaces.
No.
You know, maybe they should, but, you know, here in New Orleans, we do have a lot of green spaces. You know, I've got a huge park not very far away that it has, you know, water in it and trees and chickens, ducks and geese. And, you know, it's a lovely place. My dog still has big dreams that someday she's going to get to have herself a goose dinner. And, you know, it's a great place to go and just, you know, hang out for a while. You know, an hour there and I feel great again, you know. But not every city has that.
No. And that's you know, it's key to it, isn't it? It's part of what we should recognize as people, and therefore, you know, should we be suggesting that should happen? Should we be making our thoughts known? I don't know. It's so many people are probably kind of complacent, aren't they? It's back into this kind of TV thing.
Yeah, you know, are we better off with 27 houses, individual houses, with a postage stamp size yard?
Mm.
Or are we better off stacking these dwellings on top of each other so we can have a bigger green space? You know, these are the kind of choices that we're going to be looking at over the next few decades.
Well, we're going to have to look at them, and a lot of sort of environmentally orientated architects are certainly looking into this concept of how do you combine the way the natural world works with the way architecture works. And it's something that's kind of been missing. And again, you know, kind of something that I was looking into as part of the research that I was doing is the whole concept of what's called sacred architecture, sacred geometry, and how the architecture and geometry of the past reflects nature, reflects the world around it, reflects the people who are in it, and therefore integrally ties everything together, as opposed to simply being, like you say, a kind of block in which someone lives.
Yeah. Why don't you explain to us, what is sacred geometry?
Don't you love
sacred
questions like that out of the blue?
Well, throw it in, why not? I'll lead myself off into a tangent and think, how am I going to answer that one? It's the problem with all this stuff, and I kind of said it early on, is how do you answer it in an hour? How do you answer it on a DVD? At least with a DVD, we have some beautiful pictures that we can throw things into.
Oh, great music, too.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, the music does help, and it's also key to it, because there's a certain kind of lyrical content that underlies what's going on in the rest of the DVD.
Uh-huh.
It's not kind of one of those one-track things you watch once and it's got the answers, kind of multi-levels to it and so forth, and it does help. It's all part of the journey. I think if you can imagine, the best example is a piece by Da Vinci. Now, Dan Brown made a load of money a couple of years back with the book The Da Vinci Code, which was back-ended on something called The Holy Brilliant and The Holy Grail by Michael Beige and some other guys. And essentially what he was looking at was form within painting, form within art, but the suggestions within that painting and art that tied into all kinds of concepts about sort of Virgin Mary and Jesus and holy bloodline and things. What they really missed out was a really important work by Da Vinci, and I never pronounced this guy's name right, and I'm going to get it wrong now, having kind of grabbed it out of thin air. Vitruvian, I think that's right, Vitruvian Man is based on a Roman piece, and most people are familiar with this piece of art because it's a man basically spread-eagled in a circle. Does that ring a bell with you?
Oh, yeah, you know, showing the proportions of arms, legs, head, you know, yeah, there's a circle and it's, got it like an X.
That's it. In an absolute nutshell, that's sacred geometry. Essentially, geometry that is sacred because it is proportional. It's sacred and holy because it's proportional to ourselves. But it is also proportional to the structure of the planet. It is proportional to structures that are found in nature in terms of a harmony within the painting, within that particular picture, is based upon something called the golden mean, which is a particular ratio that is found in everything from spirals to pentagrams to various shapes in nature. And geometry becomes sacred, like I say, because of its intricate relationship with the being, with us, if you like, as presented in there. It's kind of the perfect man, the perfect dimension. And the perfect man, of course, is, if you like, either God or the Son of God. So that's why it becomes sacred, because that kind of perfection that we seek, that we express in geometry, that we express in buildings, that we express in art, underlines everything. And in that one picture, you can find examples of everything from squares to triangles to pentagrams to hexagrams to various shapes, all of which link beautifully within the geometry, within the angles of that picture. And consequently, those angles are expressed in terms of the way that we build our buildings, the way that we build stone circles, the way that we build our temples and churches. And so everything is seen, if you like, as an expression of this perfection, this divinity, the solar god, and consequently it becomes sacred geometry.
That's a very good description. Actually, I have to give you your DVD credit, too. You know, working in the paranormal field, you know, you hear a lot about dimensions, and I tend to be kind of thick-headed sometimes, I guess. You know, if I don't get an idea, I don't get it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I ask people to explain something to you, and the one concept that was forever escaping me was dimensions. You know, we talked about dimensional entities and interdimensional travel, and I'm like, you know, hey, you know, what is this dimensional thing? And then they tell me, well, you know, someone would say, well, there's 12 dimensions, and somebody else would say there's 16 dimensions, and I'm like, you know, have you been there? Have you measured them? How many? How do you know how many there are? You can't even tell me what they are. And yet, your DVD actually explained it better. I wouldn't say I have a complete grasp of the concept yet, but I'm getting there. You know, sometimes it just takes a while. Once I get it, I'll have it, you know, I'll be able to explain it to everybody. But until then, it's just kind of, okay, I'm starting to get this idea. But that was the best, because it was both visual and verbal.
It's very hard, because I had someone on the radio the other day ask me all about dimensions, you know. How do you start? Where do you start from? What I have done is, we've got a website up now for the Dragons and Rings DVD, which is called dragonsandrings.com. And what I'm doing on there is, as I'm kind of writing this book that's expanding on the Dragons and Rings concept, is I'm starting to put little articles on. So I've included an article about dimensions and Pythagoras that sits alongside that little bit of video clip where I'm explaining dimensions. So the video clip's on there, plus an extended article that hopefully, with all the kind of pictures that I put on there as well and so forth, it kind of gives people a better perspective. And I think that the hardest thing for people to get hold of is the concept that there are more than three or four dimensions, because we only see things in three dimensions. And when you try and explain to someone what you're doing, is you're often doing it on a piece of paper, if you like, and all of a sudden you're trying to explain all these dimensions two-dimensionally, and then you're working in a flat world and trying to explain something that isn't flat.
Exactly. You know, and I've had a lot of arguments with people because I said our biggest obstacle to entering space is the fact that we think three-dimensionally and we cannot navigate space in our current perception of dimensions. We can't. We have no way of mapping it. We have no way of describing it. We have no way of measuring it, because there is no up, down, left, right, you know. These don't
there
exist
isn't.
Anymore.
No, and that's confusing for people until they figure how they relate. And it's almost a case of being able to work out, well, if you look at a table, any table, if you're looking at a table or a chair or anything in front of you, essentially what you're really doing, and it becomes far more obvious if you close one eye, is you're actually seeing something in two dimensions, because you're seeing a height and a width. But you kind of know that there's a length or a depth to it, if you like, because you're aware of that. You've moved around the table, you've moved around the chair, and with two eyes we kind of have this bifocal thing where we can estimate depth, so we get an idea of three dimensions. And essentially, if in your mind you can work out that you're effectively turning that two-dimensional picture into three dimensions, then the next step is to be able to do exactly the same with that three-dimensional thing, and turn it into the fourth dimension. And the fourth dimension is effectively time. And time is all we move through. But people have a massive problem with time, because we can't quantize it. We split it up into little pieces, tiny little pieces, so we can deal with it. And then we arrange it in a straight line. And time doesn't actually run in a straight line. Time is curved. Curves all over the place, much like a piece of paper. If you kind of lift a flat piece of paper up and then kind of twirl it up and twirl it up and
take a real funny way of looking at time. Time is like a big river, like the Mississippi River.
Yeah.
Okay, it runs, all right? It's got a current. And once upon a time, when we traveled on the river, we could only go one way down the river. We couldn't go against the current. We didn't know how. You know, and once upon a time, a river meant one way.
Yep.
Okay, time's like that. Someday we'll understand how to travel on time. But right now it's like a river. We can only go one way. And you know, people look at me like I'm crazy, but I'm like, no, yeah. it's like that river, you know?
Do you know, the biggest key to it, the biggest ultimate key to it is that we all, day by day, we time travel, and we just don't work out that we time travel. Because, here's a really easy example. If you're sitting on the freeway, and you're sitting in a kind of jam of cars, all log jammed together, and you're sitting there waiting for them to kind of release so you can get on your way, time slows down. You kind of think, oh, we've been here for hours, and you look and it's only a few minutes, and it just ticks slowly, doesn't it?
And yet, oh, yeah, or that last hour at work on Friday, you know?
Absolutely. And yet, the reverse is true. We can be enjoying ourselves immensely, and we think, oh, you know, gosh, we've only been here a few minutes, and time's just flown by, and it's perception. It's all perception. All time is a perception inside our head. We create time by, if you like, cutting it up into those little pieces, and we choose how big or little those pieces are, and we do it all the time. Every second of the day, we're changing the effect of time and our relation to it. It's like Einstein said, it's all relative, and it's relative to us, and that really, to me, is the key to it, because if you can work out that time is relative, then effectively distance as a variable of time also becomes relative. So traveling from here to another planet or from here to another solar system isn't so much about inventing a machine that's going to do it. It's actually about inventing a way that's going to do it that allows us, if you like, to be part of that machine in such a way that we control the aspect of time that has passed during that journey. And we can therefore effectively use our brains, use our minds, to control that distance and to make it what it can or can't be.
So it's really not about creating the technology so much as creating the perception.
Absolutely, absolutely. And once you've figured that, you can then figure out that in fact any kind of dimensional time, any kind of dimensional travel, if that's what you want to do, can rely on the way you think it, the way you think through the day. I'm trying to relate an experience that I had here a couple of years back. Have you heard of Glastonbury?
Okay.
Have you heard of Glastonbury?
The Glastonbury?
Let's put it this way. Glastonbury is a well-known place in England, and it's quite far from where I live. If I were to get on the motorway and the motorway were to be absolutely clear, no cars whatsoever, I could probably drive there in maybe 2.5-3 hours if everything was kind of clear. But one particular occasion, I'd arranged to meet a friend down in Glastonbury at 4 o'clock. And I didn't actually get on the road till 2 o'clock. And the second I got onto the road, it was absolute traffic jam all the way down, all the way there. Really, really, you know, nose to tail traffic jams, lots of stoppings and waitings. And yet, for some reason, and I know I left because I kind of texted that I was on the way, so I knew what time I left, I still managed to make it down to meet my friends in Glastonbury for 4 o'clock. So somehow, that extra long journey, because I kind of wasn't aware of it in the way that I was travelling it, just became 2 hours, but it actually became 2 hours in real time as well.
That's interesting. Now, hold those thoughts, because we're a victim of time right now. We have already run through our first hour, and it's that time for
really?
Our break. Yeah, didn't that fly by?
It does.
Folks, do stay tuned. Check out www.exogenynetwork.com and sign up for the newsletter, and you'll be eligible to win that DVD, Dragons and Rings. So, Madonna Shays will be right back with more of our guests, Steve Mitchell, as we explore the ideas behind Dragons and Rings. Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and we are talking tonight with our guest, Steve Mitchell, the force behind the film Dragons and Rings. His website is www.dragonsandrings.com. The words spelled out. We're also going to be giving away a copy of Steve's DVD to some lucky audience member that goes to www.exogenynetwork.com. That's spelled EXOGENYNETWORK.com. Sign up for the newsletter and you'll win a copy of the DVD. And also, if you want to call in and ask a question, you can dial in at 1-877-786-0562. That's toll-free in the United States. I'll repeat it one more time, 1-877-786-0562. Now, Steve, before we get going on a topic somewhere, would you tell the audience where they can get their own copy of the DVD if they don't win it themselves?
Yes, you can go to, as you mentioned, www.dragonsandrings.com, where you can find out all about the DVD. There's some articles on there that'll inspire you all about quantum theory, all about sacred geometry, Pythagoras, all kinds of stuff that are related into the DVD. From there, you can click in either to realtocam.com, where you can buy it directly from us, or you can go on to Amazon and buy it from there. Or in fact, if you go into Amazon itself, literally type in Dragons and Rings and you will find the DVD on sale there.
Very good, very good. Now, where were we? We have wandered around the topic.
We have. Dawn of Shades. Why Dawn of Shades?
Oh, well, you know, you're one of the few people that have asked that on the air. Dawn of Shades. Okay, dawn always signifies a beginning, right?
Yep, absolutely.
All right. Shades. Now, shades, that's a word with many, many meanings. It can mean shade color.
Mm-hmm.
It can mean shades of light and dark.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has another meaning besides sunglasses. It also is, on occasion, used to refer to spirits, or you might say manifestations of spirits.
Yep.
So it's a word with many, many meanings, and it covers the many topics that go through the room.
That's okay, because you asked me about Dragons and Rings, so I felt I
ought to. You turned the tables on me? Yeah, you did. But yeah, that's you know, the Dawn of Shades was kind of, one of those things that was dreamed up in the wee hours of the night, you know? There's something, you're in the wee hours of the night.
Yeah, it's just gone 2 o'clock here, and something we were talking about earlier on when we first chatted before we went on air was this kind of creative process that seems to happen at these wee hours. It's absolutely true. You talked about the music on the DVD. A lot of stuff of that was kind of written by myself and my colleague Mike Stone, who writes lyrics, and various of our friends who kind of play along. And I must admit, we get a lot of work done at very strange hours, simply because I guess in one respect, there's not a lot of people around, so you don't get crazy phone calls trying to sell you TVs or some kind of product that you don't really want. It does seem to be more creative somehow. It seems as though something's going on where we've left that kind of daytime kind of hubbub and we've moved into that the nighttime, and our brains are working differently on a different rhythmic pattern. Our delta and alpha and beta waves are going slightly differently, and the creative sides are kicking in.
The altered state of consciousness because of the wee hours. But I did have a discussion one time with a friend of mine long ago now, and his take on why the most fascinating discussions, the best creativity spurts, etc., happen in the wee hours is that during those hours, most people are asleep. And because mm-hmm. they are asleep, they are not acting as an inhibiting force on the rest of us. He was talking in terms of psychic energy.
Yeah.
But it acted as a damper, a wet blanket, you might say.
I could see some truth in there. What I tend to do, and I said this earlier on really, is I kind of look at the way things are explained and do my best to kind of find languages that work for different people anyway. So when you're working with different groups of people, you're kind of adopting your language to them. But for my way of thinking, I like they, I guess, when I was younger, explaining to me my perception of the world and what was going on. And I guess from a kind of quantum point of view, the same thing really occurs. If you look at the quantum dynamics of things, science does show this kind of link between everything and everyone. And certainly, between us, we all agree. We were talking about time earlier on and how we agree that time is a certain reality and how dimensions are a certain reality. And it is this kind of agreedness of how the world will work. And when we're all awake, I guess you could argue that we're all agreeing far more in the locality around us exactly what is kind of real, what is physical, what is true. And therefore, like you say, in a weird way, maybe inhibiting the way our brains are able to be creative. It's an interesting idea. Like I say, you can explore it from kind of brain patterns, all kinds of things, but it's definitely true.
You think about it, and really the human experience includes this tendency to rather coerce people into conforming to the world,
yep,
their society, the society they live in. You either conform or you leave, you know?
Yes.
And, you know, some people have more trouble conforming than others. And,
absolutely.
Maybe in the wee hours of the night, we're free from that force that courses us towards conforming.
Totally. You're kind of disappearing on me again. I don't know whether it's my phone or whether it's your end.
Ah, well, do you hear me fine now?
I'm hearing you better now, yeah.
Okay, all right. I have no idea why I was doing that, but okay. Let me know if I start to fade away again.
I do. I'm very, very good at that. I'll let you know, don't worry.
It
kind of becomes very one way, doesn't it?
And even in terms of time travel, it's 2 a.m. there. It's not even quite dark outside here. In other parts of the United States, it's broad daylight. In some places, it's, you know, the sun's coming up now. Yet we're all doing this at the same time. And in a sense, you know, I'm seeing tomorrow through your eyes, and you're seeing yesterday through mine.
Absolutely. It's a very strange perception when you think about it like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, from my point of view, I just sit here and have a chat with you on the phone. Someone said to me the other day, there's all these people listening to this show, all these kind of guys out there, kind of, aren't you aware of the fact that there's all these people listening in? And I'm, in a way, not, because it's like you said right at the beginning of the show, it's us two chatting away like this, and that kind of perception isn't there. But definitely, you know, it goes to exemplify how the way we look at things alters the way they are. I'm talking to you yesterday, you're talking to me today. I'm on Wednesday already, and you're still on Tuesday.
Exactly, you know, and I did have a friend a month or so ago. He had not ever heard the program before, and he listened into the program, and he calls me up later, and he says, it was the strangest thing. He says, listening to you do the radio program was just like I was talking to you on the telephone. And I was like, well, guess what? To me, it's like I'm sitting there talking on the telephone. Yeah, you know, maybe it's in the perception. I don't realize that there's X number of thousand people listening. You know, I don't think about it. Now, I've done a lot of public speaking. I don't have an issue with an audience. But, you know, I have to admit the largest live audience I've ever talked to was like 125, 150 people. You know, that's a relatively small audience. It isn't very small when you're standing there looking at them, but, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, it makes a difference, doesn't it? I work in theatre, amongst other things. We were talking about eclecticness and sort of things we're interested in and do outside of everything else. I go into theatres and I work sort of musically, either as a director, musical director, or as a director. And that involves me kind of standing in front of quite a few people, to say the least, at various points. And obviously involves people I'm working standing in front of all those people. And you could stand there and you could see all these people and think, wow, all those faces, oh dear, you know, it's a bit overwhelming. Or you could stand there and think, wow, all these friends I've got, all these kind of amazing people who've come to see me and come to listen to me, and because they've come here for that, they're going to be friendly, and they're going, and just by changing your attitude, just by changing the way you think, you know, I think that's really, really important thing that kind of comes out of the back end of the DVD in a way. It's not something I've specifically mentioned in there, but it's certainly something I'm going into in the book. Just by changing the way we think, the language that we use, the way we describe things, changes the way they are and changes the effect they have on us, which is effectively, you know, it's changing reality, basically.
Well, you change reality the minute you make the choice to change your perception of it. You can choose
absolutely.
To perceive the world as though you're a victim of the events that happen around you.
Ooh.
Or you can choose to perceive the world as though you are in control of at least your reaction to the events. I mean, granted,
yeah.
you know, all of us can have really bad things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we don't have any control over those things. But we do
no.
have control of our perception of them and our reaction to them.
Mm. True. We were mentioning earlier on, I can't remember whether it was on air or whether it was over the phone while we were listening to other things going on, but we were talking about children with ADHD and various other behavioural issues. And again, funnily enough, I've worked in that field for quite a while, and one of the things that I encounter so much are people who use the phrase challenging behaviour. This kid here has challenging behaviour, that adult there has challenging behaviour, and we must work with it and we must do something to change it. But no one in that profession, and I think, you know, on the whole in greater society, takes on board is that challenging behaviour is something that challenges us, something that we are aware of and forces us to think. And if we could take on board that it is challenging us, then we can adjust to that challenge and, exactly like you say, change our perception of it just by rethinking the whole situation and perceive that actually if we aren't challenged by it, then that behaviour is no longer challenging. It can't be, by the whole kind of definition of what we're saying.
Exactly. I have worked with some people that were regarded as very, very difficult in the past.
Mm.
I had no trouble working with them.
No.
Because it was how I adjusted my perception.
Mm.
You know, and they weren't being really that difficult, but people who had to work with them chose to perceive it as they were being difficult, I guess. You know, and I found that they really weren't, you know, and yet other people that supposedly are so easy to work with drove me bonkers because of, you know, they tended to be vague, I guess. I find vague difficult, you know, because of
yeah.
my reaction to it. It's like,
yeah.
I just need an answer. I don't care what the answer is, just an answer. Yeah, it's all about perception. You know, and I can remember one of the biggest, I would say, mental breakthroughs I ever made was courtesy of a six-year-old child. I don't even know this kid's name. I used to work in tourism, and I was giving a, you might say, an educational presentation that blended history and science and you know, stories together. And it was always difficult when you had to give it to elementary students.
Mm.
And to make it more interesting, I have a group of gifted first graders.
Yeah.
They're still, you know, they're gifted, but they're still first graders, you know?
Yeah.
They really, you know, they don't care about a lot of things.
Mm.
And part of it that I was describing involved cratering mechanics.
Yeah.
And I really didn't get the concept. You know, I'd read all the material. I just couldn't really understand.
Yeah.
You know, how did this work? How could an impact cause an explosion without any explosive force?
Mm-hmm.
It really wasn't sinking in, you know, and I'd had a million people explaining it to me. And I could parrot the words, but true understanding? Nope. It wasn't there. Sort of like the dimensional thing. I just really wasn't getting it. I could parrot it, and that was it. And this kid asked a question, and it was like the light bulb went on in my head. And for the first time, I could see it. Exactly how this worked. And the concept was so simple when I explained it back to him because the imagery that I used was imagine taking like a coffee can or some round big can and you stretch a sheet of rubber over it, like from an inner tube or something,
yep.
and make a draw. Now, lots of kids do that in school, okay? That's
yeah.
a common craft project. You
yep.
make a little drum. All right, now you take your fist and you push it in the middle of that drum.
Mm-hmm.
And you push until you can't push anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens? That rubber surface pushes your hand back out. Now,
yep.
for the first time, I could, you know, granted, this is an ultra simplification, but I can explain it to this six-year-old using imagery. We both understand. I understand the concept for the first time, too. And it was like all courtesy of this little six-year-old boy who was being a little pain in the butt, you know, and driving his teacher crazy, didn't want to behave and whatnot. And when he asked that question, it was, you know, boom, you know, there again. You know, and it was he being challenging? Yeah, but I answered his challenge, you know, it came at the right moment, I guess.
And it gave you an opportunity.
Yeah, you know, it was just one of those things, you know. But a lot of times, the challenge is an opportunity for us to make a leap forward.
Absolutely.
If we choose to perceive it that way.
Absolutely. And I think that's the key to it as well, because you can choose. You can make that choice to say, right, am I faced with a challenge or am I faced with an opportunity? And therefore, if I'm faced with an opportunity, what is that opportunity? Get off your seat and kind of think about, actually, how can I make something out of this? And all of a sudden, that challenge then is no longer a challenge, because it's actually something that you can do about it. And then you've got that power back. We were talking about power earlier on, you know, our own self-power, if you like, to deal with situations. We've kind of got it back, haven't we?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's just... Yeah, it's Kate. Sometimes I guess we need to take our Christmas tree and hang it upside down. Same Christmas tree, but it looks a whole lot different when it's done that way. I actually,
yeah.
that's an old saying of mine, and last year when, you know, all those mail order catalogs arrive in your mail, I flipped one open, and guess what they had? An upside down Christmas tree. Yep, they sure did. And I was like, whoa! I didn't buy one, though. You know, I didn't even bother decorating for Christmas. My dog wasn't going to be impressed, and the cats were just going to use it as a climbing tree.
It's
saved myself the effort.
Quite interesting, this, actually. I'm going to drag it back into Dragons and Rings, just because I can.
Yeah, let's do that.
Why not? The example that we've given so far is the chapter on dimensions. And it's quite interesting that when you look into the Pythagorean concept of dimensions, their way effectively of seeing dimensions is a starter point of literally a point, a zero point, if you like. And the only way that point can exist is in effect to have another point to compare itself to. Now, the funny thing about that is that you end up with a number two. And in the Pythagorean philosophical sense, two isn't a number, because two in itself only gives you two opportunities, A or B. It doesn't give anything else around there to measure against. It doesn't give you a sense of where you are until you bring a third point in. Once you bring a third point, you can assess the difference between the two points by putting the third point in there. Does that make sense?
Because you use it in navigation, too, because...
Absolutely.
You can't, without triangulation, you can't figure out your exact location.
Exactly. Now, if you think of that in terms of choices, the choices that we present ourselves with, i.e., the choices that we see in our head, our life choices around us, are normally not choices. They're a choice between doing something and not doing something. And that in itself isn't a choice at all. It isn't offering you the choice of doing anything else. It is simply saying, do you want to do this or don't you want to do this? And it's back to this mystical number two in the Pythagorean sense. The two wasn't actually seen as a real number. They didn't acknowledge it as a number because of this whole kind of thing about it that until you've got the third point in, it can't exist. And the same thing comes back to choices. If you see the difference between doing something and not doing something, you're absolutely stuck. You can't choose between that because there's no real choice. But if you get to the point where you can perceive a third thing there, something else, then you're presenting yourself with real choice, because then you can choose doing A, not doing A, or doing B, and all of a sudden you can start enacting those choices, enabling yourself, and this is kind of, if you like, in a sense, the basis of neuro-linguistic programming, looking at the way we kind of language things and the way that we present ourselves with our opportunities and bring things back to ourselves so that we can deal with things.
Neuro-linguistic, you know, that even, you know, the term, you listen, you look at it, you think about it, you know, what would not be, you know, in terms of how we communicate back and forth, how could you not be neuro-linguistic?
Hmm.
You know, really?
Well, we are an essentiality, but we limit ourselves, and this is the whole kind of point to it, really. We limit ourselves by the way we look at things. We don't give ourselves the opportunity to actually see that there's far more to a situation than what appears to us in front of our eyes. Again, back to the challenge. Is it a challenge or is it an opportunity? When it's a challenge, you're only faced with that one decision. How do you react to the challenge? If it's an opportunity, you're then faced with the opportunity to do something else, i.e., do you kind of present it in terms of one way or another? Is there some way else you can manipulate or manifest that situation? And that's kind of true neurolinguistics. And I think the whole kind of concept of the neurolinguistic communication and so forth is that we do use all kinds of hidden language, but most of that language in itself is limiting language. It's do or don't language. It's not language that actually enables ourselves in any sense to actually become anything more than the kind of bounds of the language that we're using.
Okay, well, I guess that, you know, just, well, you know, I think back, you know, in independent thinking, I thought was such a good thing.
Yeah.
And as a parent, you know, dealing with schools, I discovered that apparently, in terms of how educators are educated, independent thinking is not a good thing. I was informed that my children were independent thinkers, like they had a social disease.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, that's a little frightening. You know, I thought it was a good thing to not be a follower, to think about things, to question things. I thought that was a good characteristic.
Why isn't it?
Because it's a failure to conform.
Absolutely, this is it. It's down to, and I guess we kind of mentioned in the break somewhere whilst we were chatting this kind of concept of conspiracy and stuff. There's so many areas that you can head into when you're talking about conspiracy, but essentially it's down to the point of control. Are we being controlled or do we have control? And when you kind of look at it from a social standing perspective, when you're looking at it from a settlement point of view, once man's settled down, once we have homes, once we have land, then we start to need rulers. We start to need people who can, if you like, think for us, because otherwise things start to go awry. If we all thought too much, and I'm being controversial here on purpose, because, you know,
I think the coercion to make people conform really occurred even before we settled down. You had to conform with the others in your group, or you needed to leave that group, period.
Mm.
I mean, really, you kind of see it even among, like, a wolf pack.
Yeah.
They either conform to the current pecking order, or they are driven out of the pack.
And
or
it becomes
choose to leave on their own.
Yeah, it becomes a necessity for survival, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, you have to belong to a group that conforms to similar standards. And if nobody in the group is conforming to any kind of standard, don't we have chaos?
Absolutely. Yes. Totally.
So you know, we can say it's a conspiracy, but it's a conspiracy of human nature.
It is. It is. And that's my point, really, that at the end of the day, all the conspiracy stuff comes down to exactly the same thing, that effectively we conspire. We do naturally in order to, like you say, maintain the status quo, which in a way is absolutely important. And in a way, you could argue, educators are absolutely right, and we're all wrong. We shouldn't be telling all the guys who are listening now at this second to go off and become spiritual and stuff. We should be saying, conform, conform, make society work. By
get on the treadmill, get a credit card, get a loan, get a job.
if I believe that.
Well, okay. No, I'm not real good at telling people to conform. I'm usually telling people, you know, make up your own mind. Do some research. Do some thinking. Look at things. Turn them sideways. Look at them from another angle. See what you really think about it. And because sometimes, so often I've had, even in my own life, with other, with friends and whatnot, somebody will see something new and they say, oh, that's bad, 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 that's evil. And when you actually look at it, you're like, no, it's not. This actually is in support of the same things that, you know, you're putting forth as good things, so this isn't bad, or else everything you said was bad. You know, yeah, you know, it's just, so often we are so suspicious of anything that might not fit the status quo.
Absolutely. And how do we judge good or bad? How do we judge evil or not evil? You know, at the end of the day, it is a personal judgment. People talk about negative energy, black occultism, black magic, black things, black everything, in a very kind of negative sense. And at the end of the day, it's how it affects us and how we perceive it. You know, is electricity bad or good? You can use electricity to light up your house and make all your lovely technology work, or you can use electricity to electrocute people, which is, you know, not
right.
So good. But the electricity itself is neither. It simply is.
And it's the same thing with, you know, with guns, with everything, you know. It's not that the item itself, the object, is good or bad. It's simply how we choose to use it.
Absolutely.
A fire, you know, one of the most basic things, the things that go back to our first steps towards becoming what we call human today. Fire can cook our food, it can make us warm, it can make us safe, and it can burn down our house and burn our food and kill us. And, you know, yeah, it's just in how it's used, how it's contained.
And connotations of words as well. Connotations are very interesting, getting back to kind of the whole kind of perception of how we use our language, how words become associated with things, how the word black has become associated with negative, how all kinds of things like that kind of connotate into this kind of, this social kind of understanding that this means that and that means that and you can't do anything else but. And that's kind of quite peculiar, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, and so many things have that emotional connotation attached to it. Away from secret societies.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there again, we're talking about a very basic human need, and yet people can attach all sorts of diabolical goals and processes to anything they're not privy to.
Absolutely. And all it is toys for the boys.
Yeah, you know, it could be, you know, a bunch of people sitting around drinking whatever, or it could be, you know, they're in there studying diligently on some sacred text that, you know, it doesn't matter what they're doing. The fact that they're doing it and they're not letting everybody else join them makes it diabolical.
Absolutely. Something bad must be going on.
And secret societies have existed since the dawn of time. They used to be a very common portion of society, you know, and it was a place for the men to be men and the women to be women. It was,
let's be honest with ourselves. We all go around and see each of our friends at points. We'll kind of go around for a cup of coffee. Is everyone kind of standing outside the door saying, what are they talking about? Are they having some secret confab? Are they going to own the world and run the world and turn and sort of domination on everyone, or what? You know, this is the deal, isn't it, at the end of the day?
Oh, yeah, they can, you know, yeah, people can. I have heard the most interesting stuff about me through the grapevine, and it was like, wow, why didn't I think of doing that?
Yeah, you think, I wish I'd had done that. That would have been nice. Pity.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I would have had a great time if somebody had invited me, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and there again, you know, you could assign all sorts of conspiracy and evil and whatnot, but The reality of it is, it boils down to there can never be construction without destruction occurring first. And yet, most people regard destruction as bad, bad, bad.
Absolutely. Totally. It's, that most people, it's kind of, again, what we keep talking about, sitting in front of the telly, settling down, all this sort of thing. You know, it's that, the whole kind of, I'm trying to grasp a word here, and the word isn't coming to me. Stagnating. We're almost safe. We're almost secure when we're not doing anything about something. We're almost safe and secure when we sit there and wait for something to happen, because it gives us a chance to moan about it, so we've got something to talk about, but at the same time, we don't actually have to get off our bums and actually do something about it. And, you know, that's back to choice as to whether we choose to do it, or whether we simply choose to moan about it.
Yeah, and there again, it boils down to choices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can say that we're, you know, the victims of fate. We can say that, you know, we're the victims of circumstances, of events, whatever. But there again, and then you switch over to perception.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the same event can present one person with opportunity, another one with an obstacle to overcome, and the third one can be devastated. It's the same event.
Absolutely. One of the things that sort of, for me, certainly has come out of studying all kind of secret society stuff, the sacred geometry stuff, all of this, is that there's a central tenet to it all. There's a central kind of piece of information that lies at the heart of absolutely everything, and that piece of information is very simple. It's a circle with a dot in it, and that represents ourselves and our perception, and it represents the fact that we choose effectively to create the universe as we want it. We choose to sit in the middle of it and reflect outwards in a kind of Descartesian sense. We think, therefore, we are in control of what's going on around us because we create it, because we're part of it on a sacred level. We kind of manifest that circle, and yet in a way that circle is the reality that's inside our head from which we perceive.
Well, it would be very interesting to see how humanity moves through the next few decades and how much we need to destroy before we can begin to construct. You know, are we going to nearly destroy ourselves, or actually destroy ourselves before we're able to build something new, to shift our perception, to understand how time really works, to understand how dimensions really work?
Maybe it's a necessity. Maybe it has to happen. I don't know. I don't know if I believe in whole fate stuff anyway. But it's interesting, again, when you compare ancient civilizations. They've all come to an end. They've all stopped. They've all kind of self-destructed. And yet,
this is
when
the first time we have a global civilization, you might say. Really?
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, you
is
know.
Is it?
And that puts a whole new connotation on the idea of a civilization coming to an end, because we're really kind of talking about the end of humanity here, and that's a lot of gloom and doom, and, you know, yeah. I don't want to see humanity come to an end. Now, some people, hey, I'll offer them up as a sacrifice, you know? Maybe that's evil, okay? That's my evil coming out.
There was a program on our telly over here a few days back, and essentially there's been a kind of series of programs looking at, you know, what man's doing to the ecology, what man's kind of affecting, how he's affecting the rainforests, how he's affecting the ozone layer, all this sort of stuff. And one of the programs looked at what would happen if literally man were to disappear off the face of the earth within a day. What would happen? And it showed, you know, all this growth all of a sudden, all the trees coming back, all the animals coming back. And by the end of the program, I was kind of thinking, but what are you trying to tell us? Are you telling us that this is a good thing or a bad thing? You're kind of selling this whole concept to me rather too well here.
Yeah, you know, well, you know, if you want to get in terms of prophecies of gloom and doom, there's lots of them out there. You know, impending doom. I mean, really, I mean, if you want to get depressed, there's somebody who's going to provide you the road.
But there's always been there have always been the prophecies of doom and gloom. They've always been. They're inherent in, again, almost every civilization, every archaic.
And the same complaints about children were seen in ancient Greece as we have today. That just goes to say that we're really not advancing all that fast, I guess.
No.
Children have always been disrespectful, ill-behaved.
Yeah. Remember when you were a kid?
Hey, I was an angel, okay.
Oh, of course, yeah, I was not.
Well, actually, my mother will even say that until I was about 17, I really was. And then everything busted out all at once. It was just pent up, it was just waiting for an opportunity. And, yeah, then it all came out at once. About the same time my baby teeth finally came out. I guess you can't misbehave too much as long as you have baby teeth. That's
maybe
what I told my kids, you know. You can't until you don't have any more baby teeth. Unfortunately, mine lost theirs much younger than I did.
Right.
Well, you know, you try everything you can. You know, some of it works, some of it doesn't. You know, I had one kid that firmly believed I could tell by looking in his eyes whether or not they were telling the truth. The other kid could look me in the eye and lie through her teeth. So, yeah, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, we kind of think we're in this age of doom and gloom. We kind of think that, you know, there's the whole kind of ecological doom and gloom at the moment. There's this whole kind of 2012 thing going on. And like I say, you know, it's pretty much happened down the times on a regular basis, that whether you study the kind of 1900s, the 1800s, go back to time of Christ, go back into the Greek times, go back into Babylonian times, go back into Aztec times, they all have exactly these same sort of end time prophecies and all this stuff that's going to happen and what's going to happen is. And in a way it kind of becomes that kind of way of saying, well, it's going to happen anyway, so we don't need to do anything about it. Becomes another excuse, another fate thing, another, well, let's kind of leave it to it and we'll moan about it a bit, but we won't actually get off our bums and kind of actually do something about it. And it is back down to personal choice, isn't it?
Well, you know, in terms of an asteroid coming to impact the Earth and kill us all, really, how much action can the average citizen take? I mean, are we all going to get our squirt guns out and go out and simultaneously squirt this asteroid? Really, seriously. You know, if you were told that you were going to die in the next 24 hours because of an asteroid impact, what would you do?
That's a very good question, isn't it, really? I'd probably want to spend the last 24 hours with people I love.
I think that's true for most of us. You know, but, you know, at the same time, you know, you know, it's kind of a strange thing to think about.
It is.
You know, it's beyond my ability to understand.
Yep.
I mean, everybody's going to be dead.
Yep.
You know, everything, you know, isn't going to be anymore. You know, I'm incapable of truly understanding that. Would I believe it? I don't know. I've heard it an awful lot. I mean, we all heard about the Planet X thing, and you know, we've heard various doom and gloom things that, you know, we're all going to die in the past.
I think it comes down to, again, it's back to choice. Do you choose to take that on board and react as though that's going to be your reality? Are you going to react that the world is doom and gloom and therefore not do anything about it and sit back? Or are you going to react that you have a future in which you can make changes and therefore simply go about your daily business, go about your daily life in a kind of spiritual sense, in that sense of the fact that, yes, it might happen. Is that,
and then again, you know, are we going to create our own self-destruction by worrying about it?
That's entirely
possible.
You know,
is this worry going to manifest itself into a reality?
Absolutely. On a quantum level, that's as probable as anything. Within quantum science, I don't know, you know, if you've delved into the kind of concepts behind that, but in a nutshell, to kind of take all the complexities away from it, at a quantum level, which is the subatomic level, everything is seen as a reaction to thought. the manifestation or otherwise of an event occurs because we think about it, because we focus on it.
It fulfills our expectations.
Absolutely. And funnily enough, quantum science has kind of moved up to the point where it's now saying that, hey, that isn't just at the subatomic level, that's at a world level, that's at a universal level, that the same rules apply.
Well, if you affect something at the subatomic level at a on a broad enough scale, you're going to affect the atomic, the molecular, and so forth and so on until you're affecting the entire universe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, from a scientific perspective, and indeed from an archaic perspective as well, when you study religions, when you study science, they all agree on the same thing. They all agree that effectively matter is created from energy. Now, the matter that we see conforms predominantly to Newtonian physics, that is, force equals mass times velocity, mass times acceleration, one force equals another force, and so forth. And yet, the basis, like I say, is energy, and at an energetic level, it conforms to the fact that you think something and it happens. So we're kind of underlying everything that we see around ourselves with a thought process that has indeed created it. The table that is in front of you only existed because someone at some point invented it, someone thought of it, and made it be there. The house that you're living in only exists because somewhere down the line someone had this conception of either making concrete or bricks, stacking them up into a square shape and living underneath them.
Yeah. Well, in my case, it's sticks, wood. On stilts, no less. Yeah.
On stilts?
On stilts, yeah. I live in New Orleans, the land
of
water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of quite useful.
Raised houses are pretty common here, and I live in an old raised house.
Oh, wow.
And, it's a cute little house. But, there again, it's because somebody visualized the effects of land being covered by water.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, in a way, pretty much everything that we see around us in this technological age, even, and especially, more to the point, is a result of someone thinking about it and bringing it into reality by creating it.
Exactly. You know, everything from air conditioning to internal combustion engines. I mean, when you think about it, a car, okay? I have a magic talisman. I hold it in my hand. I have magic potions. I put in my magic clock.
Yep.
And through the magic potions and my magic talisman, I can make my magic box go places.
Yes.
Okay, that's a car. I mean, it's a car. I mean, the gasoline, if I choose to perceive it as magic potions, that's exactly what it is. My key becomes that magic talisman. It won't work without my magic talisman.
No. And it won't work without your magic potion either.
Right.
And yeah, if you take that back a few centuries even and show that to someone, they'd agree with you. Absolutely, 100%.
It's all in, I guess, in perceptions. Now, do we know how the magic potion and the magic talisman work? But, some people do. I actually, if somebody had asked me to describe internal combustion, I was like, there's an explosion. Okay. It's a controlled one somehow, somewhere. I don't have to know that.
it's a bit like this concept of going to the moon, isn't it? You have this kind of small thing that's probably not much bigger than the room that you're actually sitting in at the moment, maybe even smaller. And underneath you have a huge amount of TNT, effectively. You have a huge explosion, and you blow yourself off the face of the Earth and head for the moon.
And to make it even more interesting, you have the computing power of less than an old Nintendo calculating how you're going to get there. If somebody told you, I'm going to take some dynamite, and I'm going to put you in a box and give you the Nintendo and send you to the moon, what would you tell them?
Oh, yeah, you'd get off quickly, wouldn't you? You'd go back to your TV set.
You know what has happened to us? We have run out of time.
Have we?
Yeah, we really have.
And you've gone very quiet again as well.
Oh, have I? Okay, well, I'll speak up a little bit.
You're back again.
Okay, all right. So, folks, tune in again next week for another fascinating program as we explore more ideas each week as we attempt to be prepared to deal with the difficult times we all face. Sign up for the newsletter at www.exogenynetwork.com. That's how you win the DVD, and keep checking back for the latest information. With that, I hope tonight's program has helped you all on your journey towards your personal truth. And until next week, I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.